guys, come grab a seat.
Hi, everybody. Hope you're doing well.
Guys, let me take a picture. We're going to bowl.
How long is the
3 hours.
Okay.
I'm hoping this will be one for guys.
It's only at 3:30, 4:30 slot, but yeah,
okay. Okay. So, you know, I'm sure you've been learning and living the message of our Chachamim. Mishenichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha, when the month of Adar begins, we increase our joy. And this year we actually have a double dose because we had the first Adar, which is preliminary. Now we have the second Adar. And it's brought down that all 60 days are considered to be a great, great Zman of Simcha. In fact, it is recorded in some sources that the actual story of Purim that year was on a leap year. So the actual miracle of Purim was the second Adar and the like. In fact, you know, there's a famous Gemara. You know, Haman is drawing lots to figure out what's the best month to kill the Jewish people. And his lottery comes up with the month of Adar. And he was real, real happy that the month of Adar was the month that was chosen. Did you learn why? Did anyone know why? Why was he initially happy when he came up with the month of Adar? That's right. Because he figured Adar is a real bad month because that's when Moshe died, and therefore it's an auspicious time to do bad things to the Jewish people. But there was a little error in his reasoning, and the error in his reasoning was that, yeah, Moshe died, but he was also born, so it's a good month. So the question people ask is, if Haman knows enough to know that Moshe died in the month of Adar, why wouldn't he know that Moshe was born in the month of Adar? Like, what didn't he know? So Rav Yonasan Apshitz gives a bit of a pilpul answer, and he says that Moshe was born in a leap year, but it was the 7th of Adar 1. And he died in a leap year, which was the 7th of Adar 2, many years later. And therefore, in his lottery, he came up with Adar 2. So he thought Adar 2 was only a bad month, because that's when Moshe died. And it's not a good month, because Moshe was born in Adar 1. But the mistake is that both Adars are under the same spiritual mazal, and therefore it's a good month. But okay. But be it as it may, I just want to share with you some thoughts on Purim. One of the most beloved teachings of our sages about Purim, and don't make it too beloved, is that it says, Chayav Adam Levsumei B'Purya. A person is supposed to imbibe on Purim until they don't know the difference between two phrases, Arur Haman, cursed is Haman, and Baruch Mordechai, blessed is Mordechai. You drink until you don't know the difference. Now that's a bit of an enigmatic phrase. Some opinions say, well, that just means you drink until you fall asleep a little bit, and when you're asleep, you don't know the difference. Others point out that other people point out that Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai, if you add up the gematria, thank you, is the same numerical equivalent, so it means you drink until you're not able to calculate arithmetical sums. In other words, they don't make a big deal. Others take it quite literally. But there's even a shaila, if you actually read the Gemara, it's not so clear from the Gemara that that's the halacha. It's very fascinating. After that statement is made, a person should drink on Purim until they don't know the difference, the Gemara then gives us a story that Rabbah invited Rabbi Zeira to come to his house for a Purim meal. And in the middle of that meal, Rabbah seemed to have slit Rav Zeira's throat. He killed him. That drunk killed him, whatever happened. Well, when Rabbah realized what he did, Rabbah had certain resources that we don't have. He was able to revive the dead. He prayed to Hashem, and Rabbi Zeira got alive again. So next year, when Rabbah invited Rabbi Zeira over, Rabbi Zeira decided not to go. He said, you know, I don't know if miracles happen every year. I don't want to take the chance. Now, listen to this, because this is a very interesting example how Gemaras can sometimes have two opposite interpretations. Some Rishonim say that the Gemara is citing this story to highlight the dangers of excessive drinking on Purim, and therefore it's a proof that we don't paskin that a person should drink on Purim. It's a proof against it because of the danger. But other Rishonim say exactly the opposite. Well, wait a second. If the lesson was not to drink, then why is Rabbi Zeira afraid of coming back next year? The implication is, next year Rabbi's going to drink as well. So be it as it may, the Shulchan Aruch does paskin like this idea about drinking on Purim. And I want to talk a little bit about it primarily hashkafically. In terms of actually how you do it, please pay very careful attention to your Rebbes and teachers, because it is an important issue. You know, there is alcohol abuse, unfortunately. Every year, there are actually, God forbid, there are actually casualties. There are people who die, either they drive a car or get into a car or whatever it is. So you got to take it very seriously. This year, halachically, it's a little more complicated, because at least in Yerushalayim, our Purim in Jerusalem is the 15th. We keep our Purim on Friday this year. You know, regular Purim is 14th, but Jerusalem Purim, Shushan Purim, is 15th, which is Friday. And then you got to figure out, well, gee, when do I have my Purim meal? And if I drink at the Purim meal, how am I going to daven Maariv and have Kiddush, etc.? So there's all sorts of interesting complications about that. But putting it aside, I want to focus more on the philosophical point. What does it mean not to know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman? What exactly is that idea? So let me start off with another question. And then we'll answer one question with thinking about another question. And that is, we know that every holiday, and Rosh Chodesh as well, we have a prayer called Hallel. We have songs of praise from Tehillim. Rosh Chodesh we have Hallel, maybe it's half Hallel. Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Chanukah, we say a whole Hallel, the whole all 8 days. So one question that the Gemara itself asks is, why don't you say Hallel on Purim? I mean, after all, Purim was even a bigger salvation than Chanukah. Purim, our very physical lives were in danger. So the Gemara gives three answers. The Gemara asks the question, why don't we say Hallel on Purim? Answer number one, the reading of the Megillah, which praises God by describing the story of Purim, is a fulfillment of Hallel. We're going to go back. That's the main answer that the Shulchan Aruch brings. That's answer number one. Answer number two is, you don't say Hallel on miracles that happen outside of the land of Israel. You only say Hallel for miracles in Eretz Yisrael, not miracles chutz la'aretz. Now, can anyone ask me a question on that? Because there is a good question. Pesach, wow, you guys are sharp today. That's really right. And you're mechaven to the Gemara. The Gemara asks, what do you mean? Pesach, Exodus of Egypt, happened outside of Israel. We say Hallel. The Gemara's answer is, well, that was until we came to, in other words, any miracle that happened to us before our nation came to the land of Israel, we praise. But once we were in the land of Israel and we were exiled, we don't say Hallel on miracles of Chutz La'aretz. The third answer the Gemara gives is also very interesting, and that is, you only say Hallel when as a result of the miracle you're out of hot water. Now keep in mind that even when Haman got hung and the Jews were saved, we were still under Achashverosh's rule. So what if the next year some other Haman comes up? You're not out of hot water. When you're not out of hot water, you don't say Hallel yet. By the way, that last argument, that last one, is actually part of the halachic discourse about Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. Again, that's a topic for another time. You know, the in the yeshiva world, we do not say Hallel, but in the religious Zionist world, religious Jews, many people do say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, because they consider it to be a day of God giving us at least a partial redemption. But one of the halachic arguments against it is that just as we don't say Hallel in Purim for the third reason, because we are still vulnerable and still in danger, unfortunately, although Baruch Hashem, we live in Eretz Yisrael, but we still have so much dangers around us, so it would be similar to to that third answer. That's actually very relevant for that discussion. But of the three reasons, the main reason the Shulchan Aruch gives is the first reason, and that's the one we're going to focus on. The reason I don't say Halal on Purim is because the reading of the Megillah takes the place of Halal. Based on this, the Meiri, one of the great Rishonim, has an amazing halacha. The Meiri says, let's say you're stranded on a desert island on Purim. You're all by yourself. And you happen to have a sitter, but you don't have a Megillah Esther. You know what the Meiri says? In your davening, you should recite Hallel with a bracha. Because the only reason we don't recite Hallel is because Megillah takes the place of Hallel. So the Meiri says, if you don't have a Megillah, you gotta say Hallel. A big chiddush, with the bracha, with the bracha. But the Mishnah Berurah says, we do not paskin like the Meiri. Meaning, it's not only that Megillah takes the place of Hallel, but Megillah is the only way you can do Hallel. You can't do Hallel with Hallel. You can only do Hallel on Purim with Megillah. Why is that so? Why should a hypothetical Hallel be better than the real Hallel? So, there's a beautiful explanation from the great Rav Huttner, the Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. He was actually one of the main rabbis of Rav Schiller. And Rav Huttner says the following. Hallel is expressing gratitude to the Almighty for the miracle that He gave us. So since Hallel is Shevach v'hoda'ah, it is praise and thanksgiving for miracles, the nature of the Hallel has to correspond to the nature of the miracle. Hallel has to track, it has to shadow the type of miracle it is thanking Hashem for. Now, there are two types of miracles. There is the open and revealed miracle. Let's take Yetzias Mitzrayim. There, the hand of God is obvious and open and apparent, supernatural. The 10 plagues change nature, the splitting of the Red Sea. The hand of God is so obvious, so clear. It is what is called a nes nigla, an open revealed nes. So you thank Hashem in an open revealed hallel. A nes nigla has a hallel galuya. But Purim is a very different type of miracle. There is actually nothing in the Megillah that is supernatural. In fact, even the fact that it strikes you that this is such a great story is only because we contract it. It happened over many years, and everything was moving at a snail's pace. What? Achashverosh kills his queen? That was not uncommon. People did that all the time. Esther got chosen? Well, somebody had to get chosen. Mordechai overhears an assassination plot? And then Haman plans to kill the nation that is the queen's nation? I mean, all of these are very nice, but there are no miracles, there's no splitting of the Red Sea. Everything is natural. If you don't believe in God, you can chalk it up to coincidence. So the lesson of Purim is a very important lesson. To learn to see the hand of God, not only in the miraculous, not only in the supernatural, but in the everyday operation of life. Hashem is watching. Hashem is taking care. Hashem is protecting. Hashem shows us His love in all sorts of hidden ways that we don't see unless we have eyes of faith. And when you have eyes of emunah, you see the hand of Hashem always. In fact, the Ramban actually writes that there is no such thing as nature. Even life that's normal is Hashem taking care of you. As we say in Shemona Esrei, Al Nisecha Shebechol Yom Imanu, it is God's miracles every single day. But once in a while, Hashem will do the supernatural, just to remind us He's here. Because the natural we take for granted, even though Hashem is operating that as well. That's why the word Nes, which we translate as miracle, actually means a banner or a flag. It's like Hashem saying, hey you guys, I'm here, I'd like you to notice. You don't see me much of the time, but I'm there all the time. Now you got to notice. That is why Purim is described by all of our Svarim as Nes Nistar, hidden miracle, the hiddenness of God. And you see this in so many ways. Number one, as we just said, every single action is normal and natural. There is no supernatural miracle. Number two, the name of Hashem does not appear in Megillas Esther. Yeah, the Zohar says whenever it says Melech, it's a reference to Hashem, but there is no Tiferish message, mention of Hashem's name because he's concealed. The heroine of the Megillah is of course Esther, and Esther is the same word as Aster, concealment, hiddenness. Megillas Esther is the only one of our holidays that occurs in the Golos. The Golos, the Babylonian exile. It's right before the building of the Second Temple. What does that show you? Golos is a time of Hester Panim, concealment of the divine. So, going back to the Hallel, Sir Rav Hutner says the following. An open miracle needs an open Hallel. But a hidden miracle has a different type of Hallel. The Hallel for a hidden miracle is a praise of God that is subtle, that is indirect, that is not open, i.e., the reading of Megillas Esther. So you see, as you showed, that what does the Gemara mean when it says that it is Megillah reading that is the Hallel? A Nes Nigla requires a Hallel Galuya. A Nes Nistar requires a Hallel Misuteret, a concealed Hallel and the like. And that is why Purim is especially important, because you think about this. By and large, until Mashiach comes, by and large, we don't live in a world of open supernatural miracles. Once in a while, even they still happen, but not too often. You're not going to, you know, see God split the Red Sea, or, you know, bring plagues or angels from heaven killing the enemy. Things happen, you know, the state of Israel, we have armies, we have wars, we have terrorist attacks, Rahman al-Islam, sometimes people die. More often, Baruch Hashem, the terrorists are thwarted. But you don't see any special divine intervention that is so obvious and so clear. So what could happen to a person is that you forget that God is running the show. You think it's the great security forces or the police or the army or our success in Parnassa. We might think, I'm talented, I'm educated. And we don't always feel that it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is intervening in our lives. And it's harder to have that sense when you don't see the supernatural miracles. So Purim is the great, great reminder to feel the presence of God in the ordinary parts of life, the ordinary aspects of life, the parts of life in which you don't see anything supernatural, but you know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still there. And that is why Purim is a great, great yesod of Emuna, because Emuna is, I believe and I affirm the reality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's involvement in my life, even when it's not obvious and supernatural and apparent. Okay. So that's one idea. Again, we're going to segue back to the drinking. I promise we will get back to that point eventually. Now, let's take this a little further. This idea of seeing Hashem in the ordinary can be taken one step further, and that is, not only are you supposed to see Hashem in the ordinary, but you're supposed to even see Hashem's love, in the seemingly negative and adverse. We live in a world where sometimes bad things happen. People get sick. There is death. Or even if, Baruch Hashem, it's not going to be that serious. But a person goes through disappointments. You didn't get into the college you wanted to get into, or the medical school, or you didn't make the basketball team in high school. Whatever it is, these are disappointments. And we get depressed. They can crush us. They can disturb our equanimity. And yet, a person has to know, as Rabbi Akiva taught, Kol ma di'avid rachamana. Everything Hashem puts in our lives, is ultimately for our good. It can make us stronger, it can make us more sensitive, it can make us more compassionate to the sufferings of others. Every person has to find the meaning of why these things happen to them. No person can really tell another person what is the meaning of their life. But the point basically is you got to look at your life, the good and the bad, the bitter and the sweet. And you have to know that everything is a message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to make us better, to make us stronger. You know, to give you an extreme example, I'll give you a few examples because they're just very, very inspiring examples. Some of you may know not Rabbi Saul Mandel of the center, but there's another Rabbi Mandel, Rabbi Seth Mandel. We used to teach here many, many years ago. He and his wife, I know them because they used to live in Silver Spring, Maryland, where I'm from, but they've been living in Israel for many years. Around, I think it was more than 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago already. So they lost a son to a brutal terrorist murder. They live in Tekoa, and their son and a classmate, they were like 12 or 13 year olds, they were wandering around in the beautiful caves outside of Tekoa, and some courageous Arab terrorist decided to murder two 13 year old kids by banging a rock on their head over and over and over and over again till these two neshamos, precious neshamos, died. One thing I think about is the Shelah HaKadosh writes that when a person is murdered al Kiddush Hashem, they feel no pain in the moment of their death. And I hope that was the case. But you can imagine, or maybe we can't imagine, what the parents felt, that their lives were devastated, their lives were over. They didn't, although they had other children, but it was so hard to even go on and live another day. How broken they were. But together, he and his wife started a foundation in memory of their son. Their son's name was Kobe, Yaakov, Kobe Mandel. And the Kobe Mandel Foundation helps literally hundreds, if not thousands, of victims of terrorism and their families. It gives them psychological support, financial support. It has summer camps. It has programs to give the kids who survive, you know, a sense of joy in life. And they never would have done this had they not gone through this tremendous tragedy. And instead of a tragedy breaking you and destroying you, you use it as a source of light and blessing and hope to other people. You know, there's a t-shirt saying, and I like t-shirt sayings because they tend to be true. If they're, assuming they're not obscene or anything. That is, if life gives you lemons, you make it lemonade. And, you know, that's maybe a trivial example. But that's making the point that we can't control what happens to us. That's up to Hashem. We don't even know exactly why things happen. But the one thing we do have control over is our free will. How do we choose to take what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us? Do we allow ourselves to be broken, to be discouraged, to be angry, to be resentful? Or do I use it as the source of finding within myself a greatness that I didn't know I had? Sometimes people come from difficult family situations. Parents might be divorced. Parents might be abusive. That's a tough situation, and it's not the kid's fault. The child is born into such a difficult situation. But what do you do about it? Do you moan? Do you complain? Do you become bitter? Or do you use that to become a person that would be greater than you would have been had you not had that situation? And if you want to know the truth, if you're looking for heroes in the world, people look for heroes in the world. I'll tell you, the real heroes in the world are not necessarily famous or known by anybody else, but they're the people that have all of these difficulties in their life and they use it in a positive way. Those are the people you admire. Those are the people you look up to. Those are the people you try to emulate. And I'll give you an example, even outside of the firm world. Happens to be a Jewish person. There was a a very, very famous classical pianist. I believe he's still alive, Leon Fleischer. Some of you might have heard of Leon Fleischer. And he, in the 50s and 60s, he was very, very world famous. He was winning all these awards. But what happened was, because he was such an obsessive perfectionist, he began to have a repetitive stress injury, like carpal tunnel syndrome, in his right hand. And he didn't have the dexterity that would allow him to play at his level. I mean, I guess he could do something, but he couldn't really play. Now, you have to understand, unless some of you are musicians, I'm not a musician, for someone, a musician of his caliber, not being able to play was literally life-threatening. I mean, it was pikuach nefesh. He wanted to kill himself. Right? That's how much this meant to him. And for a while, he was playing left-handed pieces. Because there are a few pieces for left-handed, but you know, there's only five or whatever. He ran out of them. So he went all over the world for all sorts of medical treatment. Nothing helped. He had to give up playing. He couldn't play. So for a while he was suicidal. Eventually he decided, if he can't play himself, he will become a teacher of the next generation of the classical pianists. And indeed, many of the next generation of the very famous pianists are disciples that he would teach. He was able to show them where they should put their hands, how they should play. And he was a great, great teacher for around 25 years. He didn't play. But he raised a whole generation of Talmidim, so to speak, who became great musicians. Okay, after 25 years, his wife reads in the paper that in Japan, they discovered some new treatment, some deep tissue massage that could restore even atrophied muscles, etc. So she wanted him to try it out. He didn't want to do it. He said, listen, it took me years and years to get over my pain. I don't want to get my hopes up and do something, because if it fails, I don't know if I'll get out of it. He says, leave me be. I'm happy with what I'm doing. I don't want to even check it out. But his wife pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. He checks it out. And lo and behold, a miracle happens. That he regains the use of his hands. And he's able to play again. Now that's a pretty amazing story. But why am I sharing it with you? Just because it's a good story? The answer is this. Here is a guy. And this is the Yiddish in the Shema talking. Even though he didn't have the chinuch and perhaps was not raised from. But listen to what he said. He said, when I was talented and I was like the best player in the world, my life was all about me, my success, my applause, my kavod, my honor. And God took away my talent with the carpal tunnel because he wanted me to care about others. He wanted me to be machshiv, somebody else's success, as if it was mine. He wanted me to be less egotistical. He wanted my life to be more about helping people and less about the honor and glory that I get. And therefore, for years and years and years, Hashem put me in a situation where all I could do would be to help other people, until eventually, their successes were as great as my successes. Their hatzlacha was my hatzlacha. Life was no longer about what gave me an ego trip. And then, when I got over the ego trip and the gaiva, Hashem says, you can have your talent back again. Because now you know what to do with it. Now, I'm not going to say that all stories have that type of, you know, happy ending, although it took 25 years. But there is that message that even in the adversity of life, you see the goodness of Hashem. It's not easy, and it may take many, many years to understand this. So, let's go back to the drinking. When we think about what it is we're grateful for on Purim, all of us think about the Yeshua, the salvation, that was effected by Mordechai and Esther. Right? That they were able to uncover Haman and Haman gets executed. But none of us are grateful to Hashem for what Haman wanted to do. Haman tried to destroy us. We're not grateful for that. That's an adversity. That's a tzara. And yet, the Gemara in Megillah says a very surprising teaching. The Gemara in Megillah says that when Achashverosh took off his signet ring and gave it to Haman, that gives him authority, that did more good for the Jewish people than 48 prophets, male prophets, and 7 prophetesses. Why? Because what do the prophets always tell people? Do tshuva, do tshuva, do tshuva, do tshuva. And how did we respond? We don't respond. We don't do tshuva. But when we hear that Haman is going to destroy the Jewish people, all of a sudden we do tshuva. We turn to God. So the Gemara says, the giving of that ring to Haman did more good for the Jewish people than 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses. Which means, in retrospect, we are grateful to Hashem not only for the salvation, we're grateful for Hashem even for the adversity. Because the adversity brought us a tshuva. In other words, it's not the pshat that when we're saved, we're back to square one. Meaning, we were safe, there was danger, then we're safe, and being safe just means we're back where we were. No! We're totally different. We've been transformed. So says, this is a commentary from the Nisivas, a person must drink, which is really a reflection of rejoicing, a person must rejoice on Purim. Till they don't know the difference between the good salvation that Mordechai brought and the terrible decree of Haman. Because both are reflections of Hashem's goodness. Both are reflections of Hashem's love. Saving us is an obvious reflection of love. But even putting us in danger was a reflection of love. Because that brought us to tshuva. You know, this is the meaning of the Gemara. The Mishnah says in Maseches Brachos, the last Mishnah, that a person must thank Hashem for the bad in the same way you thank Hashem for the good. Now, the Gemara doesn't mean you make the same bracha on bad things. If, God forbid, there's a tragedy, we make a bracha, Dayan HaEmes, God is the true judge. For good tidings, we make a bracha of Shechayanu, or Tov HaMeitiv. Different brachas. But ultimately, the understanding is, even the adversities of God, the challenges of life, are there for our good. And that's a very, very deep level. That's a very hard level to understand. But it's something that we at least understand intellectually, even though emotionally, we will grapple with it all the time. And this is the meaning of the statement we say in Aleinu, the pasuk, "Vaya Hashem lamelech al kol aretz, bayomahu yia Hashem echad u'shmo echad." On that day of the great redemption, God will be one, and His name will be one. And the Gemara asks, "What do you mean, God will be one, and His name will be one? God is one now." The answer is, well, God is one, but we see Him in two ways. There's the God of mercy when good things happen, and there's the God of justice and punishment when bad things happen. There's one God, but it looks like there are two. When Mashiach comes and we'll understand everything, we will see there's only one. That even the judgment and even the punishment and even the harshness was an expression of Hashem's mercy. And Purim, when we come in contact with the innermost, deepest part of our neshamas, is when we could perceive, perhaps, that even in adversity, there is goodness, there is love, there is care. And that is the inner meaning. A person must rejoice on Purim. Transcend the rational. Again, I don't want to over-romanticize drinking, because sometimes drinking turns into an improper expression. But drinking in its most kosher way, and again, it's very fascinating if you've ever seen like a great gadol like drink on Purim. You know, they drink, indeed, many do drink. But as Chazal say, nichnas yayin, when wine comes into you, yatsa sod, your secrets come out. Your secret identity comes out. Same gematria, right? Yayin, the gematria is 70, and so, secret, the gematria is 70. So when 170 goes in, the other 70 goes out. So whatever you are inside comes out. So, if you're a person who wants to become close to Hashem, even if the Yetzer Hara sometimes holds us back. That's going to come out. You'd be surprised. People that you wouldn't want to always associate as being so holy, their holiness comes out. That they cry and they want to become close to Hashem. And you can laugh and say, oh, the guy's drunk. But no, that's reflecting what the person wants to be. Other times, person's angry and resentful, he'll just start, you know, punching people in the face. That's also an aspect of personality that's unavoidable sometimes. So if you ever see a great, great gadol, you will see, as they get more inebriated, more kedusha comes out, more Torah comes out, all sorts of things. Perhaps in their modesty they wouldn't talk about certain secret parts of the Torah. And they'll actually do that, you know, when they get a little sicker. So drunkenness, I don't mean drunk, well that's what the inebriation of Purim, I shouldn't even call it drunkenness, is a way of getting ourselves out of the rational cause and effect world to try to see things at a deeper level. And in that deeper level, good and evil are no longer sharply differentiated categories. That even in the bad part of life, so to speak, you see the good because you're able to go beyond the normal categories of rationality. And that's kind of the inner meaning of what is going on in this idea of not knowing the difference between Orer Haman and Baruch Mordechai. Now, the thing is, we did talk about the fact that halachically, this is a bit more complicated. I don't know what is. I don't even know what psak the yeshiva follows. When are you guys having your Purim Suda on Friday?
Friday.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I'm not giving you halacha here, but I'm giving you a little background, so you have to understand the scheduling complication that Rebbeim have. On one hand, we know that on Purim you have to have a meal. And that means you have to wash, you got to make hamotzi, you got to bench. That meal has to be Purim day, it cannot be Purim night. So even if you had a big, big fancy meal Purim night, you're not yotzei, it got to be Purim day. Now Purim in Yerushalayim, as you know, is Friday. Now, you got another problem, that you're not supposed to eat a big meal Friday afternoon, any Friday afternoon, because you want to enter Shabbos with hunger and the desire for food. So how do you have a big Purim meal on Friday and yet enter Shabbos in the proper spirit? So there are two basic approaches. Approach number one, which the Ramah recommends, is that instead of making your Purim meal Friday afternoon, you make your Purim meal Friday morning before the middle of the day. So that could be breakfast or it could be brunch. Now it still has to be, it still should be a festive meal, preferably with meat and the like. But that way, the concept would be, according to the Ramah, that you would have your meal, whatever, let's say 10 o'clock in the morning, you'd be finished by 12 or 12:30. Then you could even sleep off some of the wine or sleep off some of the drinking. And then when Shabbos comes in, you're fine and you're dignified and you're awake and you're not drunk. And you enter Shabbos and you're still even a little hungry for the Shabbos meal. So that's what the Ramah recommends. The Ramah recommends basically a morning meal that is finished by midday. And you enter Shabbos fine. Now, there is another approach that some people feel is better. But again, it's a machlokas. And then the Ramah says what I said, and that would normally be what you follow. But sometimes it's very hard to make a big Purim meal in the morning. First of all, it's hard for people to eat meat. Second of all, there's a lot of stuff you got to do. I mean, there's Megillah reading, and there's Shalach Manos, and there's distribution of staka. So, and especially if you have a lot of guests, a lot of times they can't make it until the afternoon. That's why in a regular Purim, we certainly generally have the Purim meal in the afternoon. So what do you do? How do you have a Friday afternoon big meal? So option number two is actually very, very fascinating. It's controversial. And again, only follow this with halachic guidance. And that is, you start your meal as a Purim meal Friday afternoon. And you keep on eating and eating and eating and drinking until it becomes Shabbos. When it becomes Shabbos, you convert, you don't make a new meal, you convert that meal to a Shabbos meal by covering up the bread, making Kiddush. Now, you don't make Borei Pri HaGafen in the Kiddush because you already were drinking, if you were drinking some wine, but you make Mekadesh HaShabbos. You don't have to wash on the bread because you already washed, but you uncover, you have two loaves of bread on the table, you uncover and then just eat the bread. No hamotzi, but these were bread that was set aside for the Shabbos meal. And then you keep on eating, and that, in other words, essentially, you've converted the second half of your Purim meal into a Shabbos meal with only one benching at the end. But since it's already Shabbos, you will actually not say the Al Hanisim, you'll just say the Ritzeh. This is a procedure that the Gemara describes as Pores Mapa. You cover up the bread, and you make Kiddush, and then you just continue your eating.
You'd make it by Shkia.
In fact, you should. The truth of the matter is, what you should actually do is, a few minutes before Shkia, you should stop eating, then wait till Shkia, cover up the bread, make Kiddush without Borei Pri HaGafen, eat the bread without Netilas Yadayim or Hamotzi, keep on eating, and in this case you would not make Al Hanisim and Benching. This is called Poris Mapu Mekadesh. As I say, the Ramah does not follow this procedure. The Ramah says to make the meal in the morning. So your Rabbeim will undoubtedly work all of this out for you. But you should know that this year there's a difficulty of scheduling that has to be worked out. Now, one interesting issue is, when do you daven Ma'ariv and Kabbalah Shabbos here?
Isn't it the same meal again?
It is the same meal. But that's the Chiddush of the Gemara. The Chiddush of the Gemara is that even without a new hamotzi, and even without a new Tilish Adayim, the making of the Kiddush in the meal converts that same meal into a Shabbos meal. That's exactly the...
So you're not making a new meal, you're just conversing the same
That's
meal.
Correct, that's correct, that's correct. You're able to convert the meal by covering the bread, making Kiddush, then uncovering it. You've now converted Purim meal into Shabbos meal.
And the drinking?
So that's the machlokas. The drinking... I guess that would be a general question, really, and that is, whenever a Purim meal continues into the night after Purim, is there still a mitzvah to drink? I think not, but I am looking for makor. I have not found in a specific makor. But there is an issue: when do you daven here? In other words, if you have your morning meal, no problem, you go to davening, regular davening. If you're having a meal going from Purim into Shabbos, presumably you want to daven with the minyan, that's for sure. Huh? So if you take it, so one concept is you can take a break, and the halacha does allow you to take a break in the middle of the meal as long as someone is left in the dining room. And that can include your wife and your other women and the like. But then I just have to warn you that, you know, you're not supposed to daven when you're halachically drunk. So if you were drinking, and then it's time for davening, there may be a question of whether you could daven. So some prefer, because of that, some say that is a good reason to follow the Ramah's procedure of the earlier meal. So by the time Mincha and Ma'ariv is around, you're already recovered. Or some say, daven Ma'ariv after the whole meal, meaning to say, you drink until Shabbos. After Shabbos you don't drink, and then you can keep on eating your Shabbos meal, and then you can go to Ma'ariv afterwards. So there are going to be different ways of doing it. Mincha, you should daven before. If you're doing an afternoon meal, just daven Mincha before the meal. So there are some scheduling things to be aware of, because the halacha is that if you are intoxicated, you are disabled from davening. Okay? So that's just something to think of. Now, one final point I want to share with you. And that is, we all know that Haman comes from the nation of Amalek. Haman is Amalek. Haman ha-Agagi. If you know the book of Shmuel, Agag was the king of Amalek that Shaul was supposed to kill. And Shaul did kill most of the Amalekites, but Shaul spared this one guy. And Shmuel killed him, but in the short time between Shaul sparing Agag and Shmuel killing Agag, Agag managed to impregnate a woman who was undetected, And that woman is the ancestor, the child of that woman is the ancestor of Haman. And that is why there's such a poetic justice here, that Mordechai and Esther are the descendants of Shaul, and they were able to orchestrate the death of Haman, who is the descendant of Agag, because that's a tikkun, that's kind of the rectification by the ancestors. So one of the themes of the Megillah is that not only are we grateful for the miracle, but it's also a celebration of the destruction of Amalek and the downfall of Amalek. That's a very important idea. That is why the minhag of Klal Yisrael is to bang your foot or make noise when Haman's name is mentioned. Got to be careful that people can still hear the Megillah, so you know we're a little tough on that. We tell you when to stop, etc. But it is a minhag to make noise. That is an important minhag. The Rama even makes a point. Some people make fun of that minhag. They said, oh, that's childish. He says, no. If something is a minhag of the Jewish people, we take it with seriousness. Because what is going on is we want to eradicate, wipe out the memory of Amalek. Very important. But it's interesting that Amalek can attack us from the outside only if there's some type of Amalek in the inside of us. Meaning, when there's the Amalek inside, we become vulnerable to the Amalek outside. And Amalek is said to have two characteristics. One is coldness and indifference to spirituality. Amalek is described as cold, unfeeling, not influenced by Hashem, not caring about God. That's a coldness of the heart. That's why the Torah describes Amalek, Asher Karcha, they made you cold. And the other aspect of Amalek is hatred, sinas chinam, hatred of the Jew for no reason. So the two things that make us vulnerable to Amalek is coldness in our relationship to God and hatred and polarization in our relationship to each other. So it's fascinating that Purim, that is a celebration of the victory over Amalek, addresses both of these issues. The second one is the most easiest to see. If the Amalek that makes us vulnerable is hatred and polarization, so when Purim shows our redemption from Amalek, we celebrate by friendship, camaraderie, and love. What is the essence of Mishloach Manos other than friendship? What is Matanos Le'Avyonim other than compassion? Because if you're celebrating the defeat of Amalek, you have to transcend the sinas chinam that Amalek brings to the world. Now, what about the first problem that I mentioned, the coldness and indifference? So this is a bit more subtle, but I'm sure you've learned that people don't always know. This is a lesser known aspect of the day of Purim. Purim is said to be the day that Klal Yisrael re-accepted the Torah. It's a day of Kabbalah Satorah. Now the question is, what do you mean? Why did we have to re-accept the Torah? We already accepted it. So what does the Gemara say? No, the first time we accepted the Torah, it was out of fear. Hashem held the mountain over our heads and said, if you accept the Torah, that's good. If you don't accept the Torah, I'm going to crush you. We accepted the Torah out of fear. Now again, there's a whole bunch of questions on that. After all, didn't they say Naseh v'Nishma? Okay, but the Gemara says they accepted out of fear. Purim, as gratitude to Hashem, we re-accepted the Torah out of love. So Purim is a day of Kabbalah Satorah, but not the Kabbalah Satorah of fear, but the Kabbalah Satorah of love. What is the difference between a person who is motivated by fear and motivated by love? When you're motivated by fear, like you better do something or you're going to lose your allowance or whatever it would be, or be punished, you only do as little as you need to get by. You do it without passion. You do it with coldness. You do it with emotional indifference. You don't really care. When you do it out of love, you do it with enthusiasm. And therefore, once again, everything about Purim is connected to victory over Amalek. The victory over the sinas chinam of Amalek, mishloach manos, matanos le'avyonim. The victory of the coldness and indifference of Amalek towards God is when we accept the Torah out of love and not out of fear. Because when you accept the Torah out of love, you act with passion and geschmack and fervor and enthusiasm. And that's what Purim is. So again, tremendous day, and I hope that all of us will be zocha to tap into the great potential and holiness of this day. You know, it's brought down when a poor person asks you for charity, so you're allowed to check him out. Unless it looks like he's starving, you know, you're allowed to say, I want some proof that, you know, do you have a letter or something? But on Purim, if a person asks you for money, the halach is you got to give him something. Call ha-poshet yad. Anyone who puts out his hand, no snim lo, whether he's worthy or not worthy. So the Svarim HaKadoshim tell us that Hashem behaves the same way on Purim. Normally, we ask Hashem for this and that. Maybe we're deserving, maybe we're not. And if we're not deserving, maybe Hashem won't answer us. But on Purim, call up poshet yad, anyone who puts out his hand has to get an answer, whether they deserve it or not. So Purim is a day that's very, very mesuga for tefilos as to what is important in your life. So in addition to the shalach manos, matanos le'avyonim, and the dancing and the singing and all of which is great, very, very important, remember that it's the time to open your heart to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and if you give him, put out your hands, he will give you what you need. So I want to wish you all a very happy, joyous Purim.